Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the state's highest court has its newest member, Justice Kimberly Budd.
If you see fit to confirm me, I would come to the table with a different perspective on the world and how people relate to and treat one another.
But her confirmation comes with some controversy. We'll explore why. Also today, talking to your children about the presidential election. What one mother did when her son started talking about making America great again. Plus, how Boston schools are combating chronic absenteeism. Among the strategies, a daily wake-up call for students from Big Poppy himself.
Wake up. It's David Ortiz of the Boston Red Sox. Get out of bed and get ready for school. Your future is yours.
And our woman in Rio dons mask and saber only to discover...
I'm a very, very, very poor fencer.
The latest from Rio, next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's start today with news from the state's highest court. The Governor's Council unanimously approved Superior Court Judge Kimberly Budd to the Supreme Judicial Court. Her confirmation is remarkable for several reasons. She's only the second African-American female justice ever to serve on the state's highest court. She's the third justice appointed by Governor Charlie Baker. And there's this. We know how fraught the judicial appointment process has become at the national level. Are we seeing a little bit of that here now in Massachusetts? Because last week, during her confirmation hearing, Justice Budd raised some eyebrows when she shared her views on a couple of controversial issues, such as the number of people on the state sex offender registry and whether Massachusetts should grant driver's license to undocumented immigrants. So for some analysis, we're joined now by Nancy Gertner. She's WBUR's legal analyst and a Harvard Law School professor and, of course, a retired federal judge as well. Judge Gertner, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here.
Okay, so let's just dive right into some of the things that now Justice Budd said last week during a confirmation hearing that raised those eyebrows. She did get some criticism for saying that she personally, quote, didn't see any reason why an illegal immigrant couldn't have a driver's license. Now, I think one of the reasons why people kind of looked at that askance is this is an issue that could potentially end up before the SJC. Should a justice be making a comment like that in advance of hearing a potential case?
Well, actually, in one sense, it wouldn't come before the SJC in that way. I mean, she was asked her opinion as a person. What do you think about this? But if the legislation says X, she's not about to say, oh, I disagree with the legislation. I mean, that's outside the judicial role. When I was up for confirmation, I was asked what my opinion of the death penalty was, you know, and I had to give it. Although I also said if the, you know, I know that the death penalty is lawful and I would therefore apply the law. In other words, the question of what your personal opinion is in one box, and being a judge is learning how not to tap that box and to look at what the law required. To some degree, the driver's license question was a personal question,
okay,
not a
this
statutory
is really
one.
Interesting. So you were asked about, what, remind me what year you
1992.
Were put on the bench. Okay, so.
Oh, yeah, 93.
Okay, so that bench at the federal level. Here we are in 2016.
Right.
And it's just the politics that swirl around the judiciary at the federal level and the state level now. I mean, would you agree with me when you say that it's just much more fraught, very, very different?
It is. It's totally different. And it's an interesting question about why that's the case. One explanation could be that we have gone from moderate Republicans to Democrats. In other words, the division between Republicans and Democrats in our state simply doesn't compare to the divisions at the national level. I wonder also whether or not this is a function of sort of the way we do it. It's a governor's council. This is not a confirmation in the legislature where people do a fair amount of grandstanding. So it's not like the state Senate has to confirm. This is a body that was uniquely set up to review judicial appointments. And we just haven't seen that. Now, I'm reminded, in fact, that one of the best justices that we've ever had, which is Justice Marshall, who famously wrote the gay marriage decision.
Who ended up being the chief justice of the SJC.
Right. She was excoriated during her confirmation process because she was a white South African. And numbers of civil rights groups were concerned that if you're going to put a South African on the court, that it ought to be someone of color who had experienced what apartheid meant, etc. Now, what was interesting, of course, is that Justice Marshall was a white South African who had experienced, who had been an opponent of the apartheid regime and had gone through all sorts of travails as a student leader against apartheid. But that was fleshed out, and it certainly delayed her confirmation. We have seen problems like this with others, but for the most part, it seems to me it's been a rational process as opposed to on the federal level, which is less than rational.
Right. So to that extent, we're very lucky and fortunate here in Massachusetts. But even in the story of Chief Justice Margaret Marshall that you remind us of, it just reminds me that it does matter, or the process seems to make it matter about who the person is who's being appointed to the bench. And I mean, is that the reason why we do still ask questions of opinion to these
sure.
justices, and even if ultimately they're going to have to follow the letter of the law as vis-a-vis the Massachusetts state constitution?
No, absolutely. I mean, it does matter. It matters where you start. I don't think I can explain it better than that. In other words, it matters where you start. It may not determine where you finish. In other words, the rules of the case and your professional background may determine where you finish in a case, but it certainly matters where you start. I'm reminded when I just was a baby judge on my court that we were talking about a case that was worth $12,000, and one of my colleagues said, well, that's really a minor amount of money. Well, I didn't come from wealth. I represented laborers. I represented people who were accusing others of discrimination. $12,000 is a lot of money. Does that affect the outcome of the case? Well, it might affect the amount of time you spend on it. It may affect how in-depth you want to go. It may affect how motivated you are to try to find out what's really going on. So background and opinions certainly make a difference, but they're not determinative.
Okay, so this just still makes me wonder about the process and the point of the confirmation hearings themselves then, right? Because for example, the other answer that Justice Budd had, that raised some eyebrows or drew criticism, actually, was she had some answers to questions about the sex offender registry. She'd been asked a hypothetical about, you know, what would happen if a 16-year-old boy, again, this is hypothetical, was found guilty of statutory rape after having sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend. And she said Justice Budd said she thinks that there are too many crimes included on the sex offender registry. And those comments led to Republican State Representative Shauna O'Connell to call for her nomination to be withdrawn. Today, several governor council's members stood by Budd's responses and said they were taken out of context. But why then do we even ask hypotheticals in situations like this? What kind of view does it give us into the jurisprudence of the nominee to the court?
There is no question that can be asked that would give you a one-to-one view of someone's jurisprudence, because we can't ask those questions and we shouldn't. You can't ask the justice, how would you vote on this particular case? You can't do that. You shouldn't do that, because in fact you want the decision to be the product of some reasoned deliberation, and you don't want people to come into the job with, you know, the way a legislator might. I'm here to carry out this particular view. But on the other hand, the questions about general attitudes and the questions about approach are questions that give some idea of where the justice might be going on this or that issue. It's not a one-to-one correlation at all. Some of the best justices of the Supreme Court were people who you never would have predicted the kind of judge that they were. But certainly the background gives you some idea of what's important to them, who they will empathize with, how hard they will work, those kinds of issues.
Yeah.
And the sex offender question, by the way, I mean, is a widely debated question, but it's hard to imagine how that would come to the court. If something is on the registry, the court is not about to be asked, well, should it come off? It's a question that deals with general attitudes, not any particular case.
Yeah. So back to your point about perspective and empathy, we should note again, as we did at the beginning, that Justice Budd is only the second African-American
right.
woman to serve on the state's highest court, following her confirmation today. So a little bit of history being made once again there. Governor Charlie Baker has appointed two others to the court as well, and there are two expected retirements this year coming
right.
up. up. So that means that Governor Baker is going to be able to make a really big mark on the SJC, 5 out of the 7 seats on the bench. I guess my last question to you is what kind of impact could that have?
It could be extraordinary. I don't think that the public realizes, first of all, the difference between the Supreme Judicial Court in the Massachusetts and the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Judicial Court interprets the Massachusetts Constitution and has done so creatively and interestingly over the past 40 years. The Massachusetts SJC threw out the death penalty when the Supreme Court would not. The Massachusetts Supreme Court has preserved the right to choose. Roe v. Wade could be reversed tomorrow. It wouldn't matter. So this court is a treasure that requires some careful determination of who should be on it. These three justices have made that determination. I look forward to who the two others would be here, because really, this is really what matters to the people of Massachusetts, not necessarily what the Supremes do.
Well, Nancy Gertner is WBUR's legal analyst and a Harvard Law School professor. She's also a former federal judge. Judge Gertner, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, so let's talk about the 2016 election in a slightly different way now. Here's a piece of tape that's actually familiar to most adults, but when you listen this time, imagine that you're a child, a 6-year-old listening to the tape. Okay, here it is.
We are going to make America great again. We're going to start winning. We're going to put America first.
Of course, that was the Republican nominee Donald Trump just speaking at a rally in Wilmington, North Carolina yesterday. But remember, you were listening to this piece of tape with the ears and the mind of a 6-year-old. So what did your 6-year-old self hear when Donald Trump spoke? Personality? Patriotism? Victory? What was it that you heard? Well, our next guest has a 6-year-old son who was enthralled with Donald Trump. And then his family started talking about what this election means, and things changed. Kirsten Greenidge is an Obie Award-winning professor of playwriting at Boston University, and her article, How My Son Fell Out of Love with Donald Trump, appeared in Politico magazine, and she joins us now from Westboro. Kirsten, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
It's really great to have you back, and I have to say, your article in Politico about the complex navigation that you went through with your son really, really touched me. Can you first just tell us briefly how it is that you first discovered that your son, you know, was kind of a Donald Trump fan?
Well, I picked him up from school one day, and a teacher came up to me. It was not his own teacher. A teacher from an older grade came up to me and said, you know, your son has been talking about Donald Trump, and I just thought you might want to know because he's really excited about him. And, you know, when a teacher comes up to you and talks to you about your son, who is not your own teacher at the end of school, usually your first reaction is, oh, my goodness, what did my kid
do? Yeah, this is trouble.
And so I didn't really know that he was this excited about Donald Trump. And on the way home from school, we started talking about Donald Trump, and it occurred to me that he really didn't know what else Donald Trump was talking about except for that phrase, make America great again.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was just like, well, that's what he wants to do, is make America great again. And my husband and I do talk to him about current events, but we also are big proponents of that our kids should make up their own minds.
Right. Well, Kirsten, let me just ask you if I can jump in here for a second. So, I mean, did your son tell you a little bit more about, even if it had just been limited to that phrase, make America great again, what did he love about it? Why did he get so excited about it?
I think he was just excited that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
My son also grew up, you know, under Obama. That's the only president he's ever known. And so I don't think he thought of it as that we've had, you know, 8 terrible years. I think he just thought this is going to be a great continuation of of what we've had.
Yeah, because who doesn't like winning, really? I mean, and I don't say that with any facetiousness at all. To the ears of a six-year-old, the idea of greatness and winning, it just seems like a thing to naturally get excited about. But then you were mentioning the car ride home. Things changed a little bit. How did you take the next step to tell your son, well, you know, there's a larger context here?
Well, I started asking him some questions, and it became clear that, first of all, he said, when I said, was asking him about Donald Trump, he did say, who's Donald Trump? Because he'd never heard the name, the two names put together. And then I realized, oh, right, this is, he's been learning about much of the election through sound bites. And it wasn't necessarily because we were keeping the election from him. You know, he goes to bed at 7:30. We don't necessarily watch the news together. It became a conversation about, okay, let's get to the bottom of what the candidates stand for. Because at that point, we were thick in primary season, and there were many candidates. It wasn't just Donald Trump running. And so he wanted to know more about all of them. Mm-hmm. And he also had some vague memories of the 2012 election. And so every Tuesday to him was election night. And he was just confused also about what primaries were.
Right.
And we had some discussions about what Donald Trump stood for and what that phrase could mean to different people.
And so then there's a moment that you write in your Politico magazine article where, you know, you're having this conversation with your son, and you say you were like looking in the rearview mirror and you could see that his whole body language changed, right? That he had his knees up under his chin and he kind of was just looking around without as much certainty as he had before. And he said something to you that really got me. He said he said to you that all of a sudden he felt embarrassed.
Yes. He felt embarrassed because he didn't know these things.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know what that phrase could mean. He felt he didn't know about the candidates. He didn't know about the primary season. He went from, yes, America could be great again, look at this great thing that I found and I've been touting around school, to feeling like disempowered.
Yeah.
And he just kind of curled into himself in the car seat, as much as you can in a car seat.
Yeah.
And we had a lot, we condensed a lot of the primary season as far as we had gotten into the car ride to chess class.
Well, Kirsten, stand by here for just a second, because I want to introduce another voice into this conversation, because this is at the point where, I mean, your son's, the change in his reaction had to do with everything that you were just saying, that you had opened his eyes to the broader context of all that's going on in the election. And I think this is exactly the challenge that many parents face, regardless of their political persuasion. So listeners, we're speaking with Kirsten Greenidge. She's a professor of playwriting at Boston University, and she's written an article for Politico magazine titled How My Six-Year-Old Son Fell Out of Love with Trump. We've got a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. And there's a passage in Kirsten's piece where she asks all readers, how do you discuss the electoral process with a 6 and 8-year-old when the conversation is able to veer in so many different directions? How do you streamline discussions about democracy for the very young when the sound bites are about throwing chairs and adults behaving badly? Well, to help us answer that question, we've got Joseph Schrand here in the studio with us. He's an assistant child psychiatrist at Mass General Hospital and an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's also chief of adolescent psychiatry for High Point Treatment Centers. Dr. Schrand, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's delightful to be here. And hello, Kirsten. Nice
hello.
To meet you. Great article. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Well, so tell me, I mean, I think Kirsten, in her piece, asks exactly the question, how do you talk about this democratic process that we're all going through with the very young, when so much of the political language we're hearing from all sides is maybe not in the highest tradition of our democracy?
You know, it's great that people are asking this question, and I'm not sure we would have asked this question in the last election. So something's going on here where people are recognizing there's something very important going on. In the previous part on WBUR, you were interviewing Meryl Streep. And I'm going to bring this in because in Meryl Streep, she was talking about Into the Woods by Sondheim. And Sondheim, in that musical, has a great song, Children Will Listen. Mm-hmm. Careful the things you say, because children will listen. So they're listening. And how cool is that, that the kids are listening? So what do you do? Just like Kristen did, we want to know what our kids are thinking. So before we say, this is what's happening, why don't we find out what they think?
Uh-huh.
Tell me, one of the first questions would be, what is a president meant to do? Tell me, you know, and we've got these people, you know, who's running for president? That's right, right? These are the people running for president. What do you think a president is meant to do?
Yeah.
And then from there you build and you can find out what they know about the candidates.
Well, Kirsten, I mean, you asked those kinds of questions to your son. How did he answer?
At that point, he answered in a 68, I mean, he's faced a lot of confusion at that point. What's wonderful about him is that he's extremely verbal. And so I think what happened in that car ride was that he and I were able to enter into a lot of questions together. And so I was able to ask him questions and he was able to answer and also ask me questions. And I think what was interesting is also watching his sister, who is a different type of child too.
Mm-hmm.
And her eyes got really big, and it was kind of like, who's going to step in it now?
Yeah.
What am I going to answer wrong? And so I would love to be able to ask those questions of both of them. I probably will this evening, and see what they say.
Well, Kirsten, let me just jump in here because later on, in months later, you wrote in the article that there was a point at which your son began to realize that, you know, the president of the United States, whomever that might be, has enormous power, and that that power, as you write, quote, could be chosen to be exercised in a way that could have real consequences, not for someone who is nameless or faceless, but for himself, and that to be 6 years old and understand that must be terrifying. And we just received a comment on Facebook from Amanda Ferry, who says, my daughter, who's 10, has Hispanic, African-American, and Muslim friends, and she is worried about what will happen to them if Donald Trump gets elected. So, I mean, I imagine that there are people on the other side of the aisle who perhaps have those same concerns about their child if Hillary Clinton gets elected. But Joseph Schrand, I mean, those sort of existential terms are how this election is being discussed, even amongst adults. Kids are absorbing that. Like, how do we talk to them about that?
How do we help a kid remember they're part of a group? Because that's really what it is. We feel safer when we're part of a group. And what these comments are saying is that, wait a second, what if I'm not in the in-group? And that's part of what the author was saying here, is that Trump is able to make you feel included by these pithy little catchy sayings. But when you really think about it, there are so many people being excluded. That's what kids are afraid of. They're afraid that they're going to be kicked out of the group, just like they were on a playground and not being invited to play. That's what we worry about. So how do we help a kid solve that problem? By reminding them that we're one group. We are all Americans. We're all part of a global community. That's where we really need to go. It's very big stuff for a kid. I mean, it's really remarkable that a six-year-old is thinking this way, and that's to your credit, mother there, and father. But these kids are thinking, how do we help them feel safer? Because that's really what it is. It's not about America being great again. It's about we are all part of America.
Hmm. Well, Kirsten Greenidge, another aspect that really flowed around, or a thought that flowed through your entire article was, our kids, is a 6-year-old, is an 8-year-old too young to watch the news, to have discussions about the news? I mean, with your experience with your son, where do you come down on that now?
I coming out of, we had a, in those days after the initial discussion of Make America Great Again, because what he was asking me, what he was demanding actually was, tell me everything. I want to know everything. I want to watch the news. I want to listen to the news. I want you to put it on the radio. I want to read it. Everything, everything, everything. And my gut reaction was, no, absolutely not. And which is interesting because I grew up, my parents didn't have a filter at all. I grew up watching everything they watched on TV. I watched the nightly news and everything. And it's probably one of the reasons why I became a playwright, which I wouldn't give up for the world. So we do, I'm much less reactionary when sound bites come on the radio. I'm much less apt to turn it off or down now. And much more willing to enter a conversation with him and discuss with him, which I thought I was doing before, because I, you know, I live in Cambridge, or I they go to school in Cambridge, and so I thought I was doing that before, and I really the winter proved that to me that I was not.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm much more willing, even though it is very difficult, and we end up into some conversations where I feel like, as a parent, I don't know the answers, or I don't know how to answer things, and we get into some topics where I'm just like, oh, wow, this seems like it's above his head.
Yeah.
But he appreciates being part of the conversation.
Joseph Schrand is nodding. You're nodding your head yes.
Yeah, yeah. Because, again, what's wonderful is we meet our children where they are, and sometimes kids will really fool us, and they think that they absolutely know what's going on. I mean, there's that, not to put teenagers down, but there's that great, you know, bumper sticker, hire a teenager, they know everything. But kids want to know, and the fact that your son was embarrassed is not insignificant. Something was going on where he felt that other people were judging him a certain way. And he didn't expect that. I'm not, you know, doing the shrinky thing, but that's where kids are at. I think part of it is by having a discussion with kids where they're at, great things happen. It's more interesting to know what our kids are thinking. But there are certain principles that we want. We want our kids to be kind, to be generous, to include other people, to feel that they can give something, to persevere.
How do we do that, though, with the political conversation being what it is in August 2016, whereas we were talking about earlier, the forces seem to be towards exclusion, not inclusion, and not, you know, citizenship?
I think we got to bring it down to the playground level in many ways. You know, if you're talking about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton and you're sort of examining their political points of view from a six-year-old perspective, I think you can ask someone like, well, which one seems, you know, like they would be a part of your class? Are there kids in your classroom who they remind you of? Are there, and you don't want to necessarily push them down the bully road or something like that, but you can certainly say, what do you think about Donald Trump when he says this? Did you know that he said this? What do you think he means when he says this, this, and this? Mm-hmm. Get their opinion.
Yeah. Well, we're fast running out of time here, but Kirsten, last question to you. How are the I guess we're in summer, right? So maybe there aren't so many car rides home. But how are the equivalent car rides now with you and your two kids?
They're great. I mean, it's a lot of, there's actually a lot of car rides because there's less school, so we're together a lot. And the political discourse has ramped up. We did watch some of the the conventions together, and it has been interesting. It has been a crash course in democracy and watching both conventions. We've had discussions about what conventions do, what they mean to each candidate, and I think the kids are enjoying it and also a little bit wary of the democratic process in a way that I think their grandparents, who are very much committed to the democratic process and voting rights, would be would be enamored of and might be slightly worried about.
Yeah.
But we've had many great discussions about what it means to exercise your vote to choose who your elected officials are.
Yeah, so keep talking. That's the lesson I'm gathering from both of you. Well, Kirsten Greenidge is a professor of playwriting at Boston University. She's an Obie Award-winning playwright of several plays, most recently Milk Like Sugar and The Luck of the Irish. Kirsten, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Joseph Schrand is an assistant child psychiatrist at MGH and an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's also chief of adolescent psychiatry for High Point Treatment Centers. Dr. Schrand, it was great to have you as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And let us know how you're talking to your kids about election 2016. Send us a comment at our website, radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In Rio de Janeiro, American athletes are still on a tear. This morning, 42-year-old Kristen Armstrong captured her third consecutive gold medal in the cycling individual time trial. And of course, there was Team USA's incredible performance in the team finals of women's gymnastics yesterday. Here's Needham native Ali Raisman speaking to NBC's Today Show about winning gold.
Well, I mean, it feels pretty heavy, but we're very excited. Yeah. It doesn't really feel real, but, you know, we worked so hard. I had someone ask me tonight if we slacked off because we were the favorites to win, and it's the exact opposite. Yeah.
Joining us now from Rio is the Boston Globe's Shira Springer. Shira, it's great to have you back.
Good to be back on a rainy day in Rio. I know there are a lot of people out there who might not think it rains here, that it's always sunny and it's all coconuts, but it's not. It's a very rainy, overcast day here.
Well, it may not be sunny in Rio, but it's definitely gold for Team USA. I mean, let's start by talking about the U.S. women's gymnastics team. And you said dominant the last time we had you on the show, and they expressed that dominance last night, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, there was never any doubt. In the modern era, it was a record margin of victory. I believe it was an 8 points over the Russians. So never any doubt that the U.S. team would take home the team title in women's gymnastics. It was really just a question of how large the margin of victory would be, and it was quite large. And I think we can expect continued dominance from Simone Biles and company for the remainder of the games here.
Second largest margin of victory in Olympic history, that 8-point margin over the Russians. And of course, everyone on social media is also leaning, just like Ali Raisman's parents are every time they watch their daughter do amazing things out there in gymnastics. So just a lot of great stories from Team USA there. Let's move to the other big name event this week, and that's swimming. I mean, we could pick any one of the USA Team USA athletes to talk about, but let's start with Katie Ledecky.
Yeah, I mean, what is left to say about Katie Ledecky in some ways, because she, like the U.S. women's gymnastics team, has been incredibly dominant in her events and at these games. Last night, she won her second swimming gold medal of the games, taking the title in the 200-meter freestyle. And now the impressive thing was, for Katie, this is the 200 is a bit of a sprint. She's used to longer distances. And she was fifth after the first 50 meters, and second by the halfway point, and then she surged into the lead and was there for the rest of the way.
Yeah, and turning to Michael Phelps, of course, who we have to just at least make mention of, he won his 20th and 21st gold medals, his second and third at the Rio Games. And I love this fact. At 31, he's the oldest swimmer to win an individual race. I mean, almost seems like there's nothing he can't do.
I was going to say, it's frightening, isn't it? With, you know, 31 is considered ancient in swimming. And, you know, he has looked better, and he has said as much that he is more focused, better prepared mentally and physically for these games than he was in London. And it's clearly showing in the pool. And he also looks like he's having a lot of fun sort of telling the crowd to kind of come on, let him hear it. I mean, he looks like a guy who's immensely enjoying himself in the pool and really making the most of what he says will be his last Olympics. But you know how these athletes are always saying they're going to retire, and then lo and behold, 4 years later, they can't resist the siren call of the Olympics and they're back.
Well, let's move on now to one of my favorite Olympic sports, and that's fencing, because a couple of Americans will be fencing saber, I believe, today or this week. And you actually got a lesson or a test bout with one of them, Olympian Daryl Homer, right?
Yeah, the number 10 ranked fencer in the world currently. He was number 5 ranked when I took him on. I don't know what that says. I hope I didn't, you know, wreck his confidence or anything like that. But yeah, he was in Cambridge for a tournament recently, and he offered to give me basically a 15-minute primer in fencing and then fight me. And the results are, I'll also say it, absolutely hysterical, because I'm a very, very, very poor fencer. And I will tell you this, I run marathons, but after fencing Daryl for about 30 minutes, I was absolutely drenched in sweat. It was exhausting.
He was very gracious to you, I have to say.
Yes.
It looked like, though, he could have just like stuck his arm out and flicked his saber around and had a cup of tea while he was actually fencing you. But
yeah, and you know, in his, well, he doesn't need a defense, but he did say to me that he was going at about half speed and half intensity. I think it was more like 10% speed and 10% intensity. So.
Well, we've got a link, by the way, to this video that we're talking about at our website, radioboston.org. Shira, let's just step away from the joy of the actual athletics for a second, because this morning you were at a press conference where Olympic officials answered questions about the possible shooting at a media bus today. What's going on there?
Yeah, it was just bizarre theater in some respects. Now, I don't go to a lot of these IOC press briefings, but I've been to a number, and this ranks right up there with one of the most bizarre that I've attended. So what happened was, last night, a media bus returned to the media press center with basically what appeared to have its windows shot out, or two windows shot out. They were shattered, and the passengers on the bus said that they had been shattered, the windows had been shattered, that they had been shot at while they were traveling from one venue complex up in the north of the city back to the media press center. And they were adamant that they had heard gunfire, and that was the cause of all of the damage to the bus. Now, this morning, the head of security for the Rio Olympics and the chief Rio organizer, as well as an IOC representative, said that no, there wasn't any gunfire, and that it was rather a couple of rocks thrown at the bus. All the reporters gathered there, including one of the reporters was a woman who had been on the bus when the incident happened, did not buy the line that the officials were putting out at this press conference. And there were some heated exchanges between the media and officials. So this is something to be monitored, because obviously Rio is trying to downplay the security risks of holding the Olympics in what was already a violent city with a lot of violent crime. And now this incident with the media bus is probably, you know, is the latest of several incidents that have happened both to media and to spectators and to some athletes, in fact.
Well, Shira Springer is the Boston Globe's Olympics columnist, and she's our woman on the ground in Rio. Shira, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, starting next month, Boston Public High School and middle school students might get a special morning wake-up call.
Wake up. It's David Ortiz of the Boston Red Sox. Get out of bed and get ready for school. Your future is yours.
That's right. Boston families can opt in for a BPS service that provides an automated wake-up call from Big Poppy himself. It's an effort to combat chronic absenteeism. That's when a student misses 10% of the school year, 18 days or more. This past year, almost 30% of BPS K-12 students were chronically absent. A new WBUR analysis found that most of those students live at or below the poverty line. 8 out of 10 are Black or Latino, and most are teenage boys. Tanya Mosley dug further into those numbers. She's senior education reporter for Edify, WBUR's new multimedia home for education coverage in Boston and beyond, and that launches today. And Tanya joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
It's great to have you. And what a fascinating report. I mean, you took a direct look at the population most affected by chronic absenteeism, and as we mentioned, Black and Latino teenage boys. Why was this a challenge particularly for them?
Well, I'd first like to say this is not just a problem in Boston. It's a problem nationwide. Nationally, Black and Latino males are chronically absent at higher numbers than other populations. And I like to parse this out even further. I like to look at first what's happening in the classroom and what's happening outside of the classroom. So first, I'll go with what's happening in the classroom. And there's so many different reasons, but here's one that really stands out. So we did an analysis of the data from the Federal Office for Civil Rights, and we found that Black male students within BPS are disciplined at a much higher rate and are more likely to be suspended for minor incidents that other groups are not.
Right.
And this is the case nationally as well. And there's a direct link between suspensions and chronic absenteeism. So a child is sent home, they fall behind, and then the cycle continues. Mm-hmm. So now let's look at outside the classroom. There's so many different reasons, but of this population of Black and Latino boys, a large percentage of the chronically absent kids are living in poverty.
Right.
They're living in unstable environments. And some of those families that they're a part of have also never finished high school. So oftentimes you'll find a mom or a dad, and often grandparents as well, who've never finished high school. And so back to this issue of unstable environments, I met with Manny Allen. He's the re-engagement manager for the Boston Private Industry Council that works in partnership with BPS. And his job is to try to help kids get back into school after they dropped out. And he has something really interesting to say about this issue of some of those environmental factors.
In other places, if you're not going to school or you're not working, you can sort of tell that, you know, your movements are not consistent with success or they're not norm. The difference between for urban youth is that there are a lot more examples to support you not moving forward.
Support you not moving forward, as he said. And you laid out some of those examples a little earlier, Tanya. But let's focus for a second, if we could, on the high school population in particular, because absenteeism, as you found in your analysis, is particularly an issue for students in high school, obviously in terms of the impact that it has on them. But tell us more about what you found.
Sure. On the high school level, so there are a couple of different reasons here that I found. So you remember when you were in high school, right? You have much more freedom. You're much more in control of your daily activities and what you do in and outside of school. There's also this issue of falling behind. So oftentimes, the Federal Office for Civil Rights also found that kids who are not at reading level by third grade are more likely to be chronically absent by the time they're in high school. Mm-hmm. So you get to high school and you hit a wall, essentially. Maybe you can't pass the MCAS. Maybe you can't keep up in class. And then there are also these environmental factors outside. So maybe now you're 15 years old and you want to make money. You need to make money. Your house basically is a house where you may live in a single family home and you feel responsible for being able to take care of yourself.
Right. But you, in your reporting that we heard this morning on Morning Edition, you also talked to young people who are trying to get back into school and overcome the effects of their chronic absenteeism. Can you tell us about some of the people you met?
Sure. Well, I actually talked with several young men in Roxbury who at one point or another, they were chronically absent and then they just fell off and quit school. And one young man in particular, Omarin Khan, he's 21 years old. He told me the story of how this all started for him in middle school. He was bullied a lot. He said he was really small. He was different. He was bullied to the point where he went to three different middle schools. And then in eighth grade, he had a best friend who was shot and killed over a bike. And from that point, all of these things just coming at him at the same all at once, he just fell behind and he didn't have an interest in school anymore. So by ninth grade, he was almost 19 years old and he left to go work.
Wow. Well, Tanya, hang in here for just a second because you've laid out a very interesting analysis of chronic absenteeism, who is chronically absent at BPS, in BPS schools, and the effects that has. I'm going to come back to you, but we have another guest in the studio with us. Colin Rose. He's assistant superintendent for the BPS Office of Opportunity Achievement Gaps, and he also taught at the Higginson Lewis K-8 School in Roxbury, and he's joining us to talk about efforts to overcome chronic absenteeism. Mr. Rose, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, Tanya has really laid out the fact that there are particular populations at BPS who are vulnerable to this problem. How are you trying to fight chronic absenteeism in Boston schools?
Well, chronic absenteeism is an ecological problem. Just like you said, there's a myriad of reasons outside and inside of schools. So there's no one fit and silver bullet to solving it. We have some targeted programs directed towards chronic absent students that we just started piloting last spring through My Brother's Keeper and the mayor's mentoring opportunities. It's called Success Mentors, which matches one-on-one students who are chronically absent. That was currently being run at the Burke High School and the English High School for ninth grade. We saw a 5% increase in the students who were chronically absent just within 3 months.
So 5% just within 3 months?
Just within 3
what
months.
What made the difference?
Just talking with a lot of the students, it is that one-on-one connection back to school, especially in high school. We started looking at kindergarten also, because kindergarten has a very high population of chronically absent students, but that's for a different reason. Now we're talking about engaging families,
right?
Because kindergartners are obviously not choosing or not choosing to come to school.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a myriad of reasons. That's one way that we can attack it, but we're not going to mentor our way out of this. So we have to think about, on the front end, how are we stopping students from sliding into becoming chronically absent?
Well, so let me ask you about that, because I was looking at some reporting on this from a while ago, and I found this quotation from Hedy Chang. She's the director of Attendance Works a couple of years ago. It's a national organization devoted to lowering chronic absenteeism. And she was quoted as saying, "You have to create a climate for kids so they want to go to school." And it sounds like that's a little bit about what you're getting to there.
Yeah, so some of the things that are in direct control of the school system is, do we have safe, welcoming schools that are connecting to all of our students? Are our staff culturally proficient and really building relationships with students, which is vitally important, especially in high-poverty areas where students might be behind already? And then you get the issues of students that fall behind, feel disconnected to school, and then just stop coming because they're unsuccessful and they haven't found anybody to connect to.
Mm-hmm.
And so really thinking about professional development with our staff, our teachers, our leaders around these issues of cultural proficiency.
Okay. And so, I mean, how do you do that? Because the teachers are the ones who are interacting with the students day in and day out. I mean, they must have some great ideas and want to be more part of this process.
Yeah. I think it's not disconnecting pedagogy from relationships with students. You know, I was a math teacher for a long time. In the first week of school, I realized that I really needed to get to know my families and my students. So we didn't even really touch a math problem the whole first week. We did identity. We talked about, you know, what are you as a mathematician? Well, who are you as a student, and who are you as a person? So I could really get a connection with the students. And we need that mindset from all of our teachers, because
yes,
it's the profession of teaching is not just the X's and O's of do you know your subject. It's really a people interface profession. You need to know who you're teaching. And in regards to chronic absenteeism, because there's such a great amount of reasons why a student might not be coming to school, you really absolutely need to know the student, their family, so you can properly service what they have, because it's not just about engagement all the time.
Hang here for just a second. Tanya Mosley, I want to bring you back here, because we were talking about a couple minutes ago about how many of the students slide into chronic absenteeism because of disciplinary action and suspension, mm-hmm, beforehand, and that Boston's, the picture there in Boston sort of mirrors
The picture nationally.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you find in your reporting, and I'll ask Colin this as well, but, you know, what were there efforts to reduce suspension rates? And because that seemed like it would have an effect on then, you know, knocking down absenteeism rates.
Actually, and yes, absolutely. And actually, that's the next set of stories that I'm really looking at, is some of the ways that BPS and other districts are approaching discipline. Now it's part of the conversation. Now, mm-hmm, we're really talking about some of those layers and how they affect some of these other things. You know, really, many years ago, we were just talking about chronic absenteeism or attendance rate, and we weren't connecting it in any way to some of these other systematic problems.
Right. So, Colin, I mean, tell us BPS's view. about this?
Well, I want to start actually with chronic absenteeism, kind of the definition of it. So it doesn't matter why you're not there. So quite often you'll see students that have been suspended be on those lists because those days count as you not being there. We're just really concerned about the fact that you're not there for instruction for that day. So if we're chronically absent, we're missing 10% of our days, we've missed a whole month of school, regardless if it was excused, you were sick, you skipped school, you were suspended. So that's really the definition of chronic absenteeism. Mm-hmm.
So then reducing suspension rates or changing discipline so that not many kids are kept out of school would make a difference.
Absolutely. We're looking at exclusionary practices across the board. We have a new social emotional learning office where the attendance monitors are and the strategies around the discipline policy are being looked at and reviewed. And we're actually building capacity into things like servicing homeless students. Because, mm-hmm. Again, it's not just about in the classroom things. There are quite a great amount of barriers that are societal that we can actually help to overcome.
Well, we've got just a couple seconds left, but Tanya, I want to give you a chance to celebrate EDIFY.
Yes,
WBUR's new education initiative. We've got 10 seconds. Tell us what EDIFY is going to be doing for listeners.
So we are covering education. We're not just telling you what's happening, but we're telling you why it's happening. And this is a story that really looks at that, like some of those issues beyond just the numbers on why we're seeing the issues that we're seeing within our schools.
And across platforms, so on the radio, online.
Online as well, and through social media. That's
everywhere.
Right.
Well, Tanya Mosley is senior education reporter for WBUR's EDIFY. Thank you so much. We look forward to having you back.
Great, thank you.
And Colin Rose, assistant superintendent for the BPS Office of Opportunity Achievement Gaps. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's it for today. This is Radio Boston.